Hi, I'm Dr. Pam Peek, and welcome to episode 90 of Her, the podcast all about women, where we share the naked truth about her mind, her body, and her life. And today, it's her decision-making. Before we get into this episode, please know that it's made possible by our wonderful friends at Smarty Pants Women's Complete Vitamins. They're delicious once-a-day gummies that contain the complete vitamin, mineral, folate, and omega mix, customized for women. Trust me, you won't forget to take them because they taste so great. To learn more, go to SmartyPantsVitamins.com. And just a quick reminder to hop on over to iTunes after our episode to rate and review this podcast because I want to hear from you. And I read these things. Yes, wipe the shock off your face. I love to hear from you. All right, it's time for her.
Her. The podcast.
The naked truth about women.
Her mind. Her body. Her life. It's all about her.
How do women decide? How do we make decisions? Why is this a big flippin' deal anyway? Because it is a big flippin' deal. And we have the author of How Women Decide What's True, What's Not, and What Strategies Spark the Best Choices, Dr. Therese Houston. She has a PhD. She's looking to change how we talk about women at work. She's a cognitive scientist at Seattle University, and the New York Times calls her new book, How Women Decide, required reading on Wall Street. Hello, Wall Street. Listen up. She debunks popular myths about how men and women make decisions. And last fall, she gave her first TEDx talk on why groups make better choices when they include women. Who knew? Therese received her BA from Carleton College and her PhD in cognitive psychology from Carnegie Mellon University. And every corporation and their flippin' brother, including Microsoft and Amazon, has had her in to lead workshops on how to create more inclusive workplaces for women. Therese, welcome to the Her Podcast.
Thank you so much, Pam. I am smiling already.
Oh, listen, this is the coolest ever. Well, since we both own a pair of ovaries, we kind of know the gig here, right? I mean, we're both professionals. I'm a physician. You're a cognitive, you know, a scientist, psychologist. And really, at the end of the day, we've seen in our own lives what goes on with women in decision making. I'm kind of curious why you decided to choose this topic for the book.
Well, I was researching. I wanted to write a book where I took some complicated science and unpacked it so that really smart people who weren't necessarily scientists could enjoy it and use it in their everyday lives. So that was my goal, and I was looking around for topics, and I love the books on decision-making. When I look at my bookshelves, I have a bunch of popular books on decision-making, like Predictably Irrational and Thinking Fast and Slow. There's some great ones out there, but they're all written by men. And if you look closely at the examples they give, they mostly give examples of men. And it got me thinking, like, wait a second, how are women making decisions any differently? Why aren't women being discussed in these great books? So I started doing some research, and yes, there's plenty of great research out there on gender issues in decision making. And I started piecing it together in a book, and I started interviewing women and got some fabulous stories of pressures that women had in different workplace situations to make decisions differently. And I knew I had a great book idea.
Well, how do women make decisions differently?
Well, so there are a bunch of stereotypes out there, right? So there are stereotypes like it's a woman's prerogative to change her mind, right? And this notion that women are less decisive than men. We can talk more about that one. That one happens to not be true, by the way. Men tend to be just as many problems making decisions as women. So decisiveness, that doesn't differ between men and women. But one important place that there is a difference, and this one will probably come as a surprise, is that women actually tend to be more analytical than men, right? So by that, I mean there's this notion of women's intuition, right? Have you ever heard the phrase men's intuition?
Never.
Never. Well, by the time we're done with this conversation, you'll be using it, that phrase, men's intuition. So we tend to think of women as being the intuitive ones and men as being the analytical ones. But there was this fabulous study just done back in 2012 by a team in the UK. And they collected studies that looked at how men and women approached problems. And they analyzed whether men were taking a more intuitive approach to decision-making and problem-solving or a more analytical approach. Analytical meaning, are they gathering data? Intuitive mean, are they going with their gut? They can't really explain their decision. And then they looked at women as well. You know, were women being more analytical or intuitive? And they found that in 40% of the 32 studies that they looked at, 40% men adopted a more intuitive style than women. So men went with their gut, or they had a hunch and they couldn't explain it. So you're doing the math right now, right, Pam? And you're thinking, well, if 40% of the studies found that men were more intuitive, that must mean that in the other 60% of the studies, women were more intuitive. But that's not what happened. In the other 60% of the studies, they found no differences between men and women. In none of the 32 studies did they find that women took a more intuitive approach than men. So the conclusion that we can draw from that is that, in general, women tend to take a more analytical approach, if anything, than men do. Women are more likely to go look at the data as opposed to being able to just sit comfortably with going with a hunch.
God, that's really interesting. Excuse me while I wipe the shock off my face. Because, I mean, you really killed off a few really potent stereotypes. That what? Whole issue of intuition, a woman's intuition. Where the heck did that come from?
Well, I've been trying to figure that out. And I haven't been able to find a good historical reference. I think it's interesting because men are more likely to say things like they're going with their gut, or they're going with a hunch, or I've got a good feeling about this or a bad feeling. Whereas people are more likely to say women are deciding with their hearts, right? They're going with their heart. And it's interesting. Men wouldn't say I'm going with my heart, but they are just going with a different part of their body they can't quite explain. So I think it's very interesting that we've got these stereotypes out there. And I think it gives people a reason to miss women's decisions.
And that whole issue of analytical, I think that a lot of women who are listening to this Her podcast are saying, hey, what? Really? Women are quite analytical? And what does analytical really mean?
Good question. So what it means, Pam, by analytical is that you're seeking out data to test an idea. You're going to go on vacation and you're doing research on, okay, so I found this place, but I want to look for other reviews of the place where we're going to stay before I put down our deposit. Or you're making a decision at work, like you're trying to decide if you're going to put forward a proposal in a meeting before you raise your hand and offer that idea. You crunch the numbers around, like, okay, so all right, exactly how much is that going to cost? How much of a risk are we going to take if we do that? So it's being rational and deliberate, where there's a specific steps that you're going through, as well as being able to explain the argument point by point. And when people have an intuition, it's not that they can't generate an argument, it's just that they have the feeling and then they generate the argument, as opposed to, all right, here's what the data shows and here's where the argument leads.
How fascinating. Well, I have a wild thing here. Okay.
So one day,
so one day my husband and I decided to take the Myers-Briggs, you know, I think I took it at some point when dinosaurs ruled the earth. I couldn't even remember what the heck it said about me. But so we did this, you know, psychological testing, kind of look for trends in, you know, how you look at the world and back.
Sure.
Are you introspective, you know, all that.
Yes, extroverted,
but there was
right.
This one part of it. You're the one who's the expert on this. And so this was hysterically interesting. It was one thing on decision making. If you remember, there's like a, you know, there's a subsector on decision making, and there's two columns, and you add up the little numbers and everything to kind of see where you are. And on one column, you know, is kind of like waffling and not sure and gosh, I don't know. And then the other one is like acid focus, like, ah, sure, you know, no problem. All right. So I did mine and he did his. And no shock to us the way it came out. His mine, let's start with mine. On the waffling column, it came out zero. I do not waffle. I am the most acid decision. It just give me I'm analytical. You know, you want to shop with me. This is a good thing. I walk in there and I kind of, you know, I will hone in on this. I'm not like you know, wandering for hours. Now, my husband, interestingly, and because I have a scientific question here, my husband ended up, I'm not kidding you, and this is so him, all right? One column equaled the other. He cannot get off first base. I mean, in other words, he's got equal waffling and equal, you know, focus. And I must have laughed because that's him. You know, he'll constantly, well, gee, really? Should I make that? I'm like, oh my God, just let me tear what little hair I have left off my head, you know, trying to work with it. Now, how accurate are those kind of tests about decision making?
Well, good question. So you know, what's interesting about things like the Myers-Briggs is that people often shift a bit over time. So it'd be interesting for both you and your husband to go back and take it now and see if you score similarly to the way that you did before. It's not that you're an entirely different person. It's just, for instance, people can become a bit more extroverted or introverted based on their life experiences, right? So you may have had, or your husband may have had experiences that would have changed things in terms of, you know, how focused and immediately he makes a decision or how much he wants more information before he decides. How accurate are they? There's a real debate about that. So people tend to like to take them. The Myers-Briggs is one of the most respected tests out there in terms of personality. But other people have a hard time, other researchers have a hard time making predictions based on those things. So they're useful, helpful in terms of insight, in terms of work styles, but can you predict, you know, for instance, what kind of house you should buy based on this, or who should do the house buying, right? You or your husband? You know, that part gets tricky. So there's mixed evidence as to how those things map out in the future.
Well, you know, the reason why I ask is you do so much work with the workplace, and Myers-Briggs is used by a lot of employers.
A lot of people like it, and they find it really helpful because if you, instance, if you're, you know, if you're really high on the introverted scale, for instance, and you work with everyone else you work with is high on extroversion, it can help you understand why it is people keep stopping by your office to talk through decisions. And you're just like, really? I just want that door closed so I can think about the decision, right? So it can offer insight as opposed to they just are insensitive or they're annoying. It can offer you insight. Well, they're people who want to talk through their thinking process and that they get energy from interacting with other people, whereas it's draining for you as an introvert. I'm not saying that you're an introvert, but if you were, that profile can give you an understanding of their behaviors.
Fascinating. So you work with, you know, you talk in your wonderful book, How Women Decide, a lot about, you know, you give a lot of examples about women in the workplace, et cetera. And you're also offering some tips and tools and techniques where the workplace can be more woman-friendly with regard to decision-making. So when you first looked at the science of what's going on in the workplace and women in decision-making, did you stumble upon discoveries there that really gave you an, oh my goodness, an aha moment about what was transpiring in the workplace as it exists today?
I think one of the biggest aha moments for me was looking at some of the research on how men and women make decisions under stress, right? So some decisions, So some of the decisions we make at work, everybody's calm, you know, you've got plenty, you know, you've got time to make the decision. You can look at all the data. You can talk with different stakeholders. But there are other decisions that we make at work that are made under a lot of pressure, right? Your boss says we needed this decision yesterday. and you need to bring five people together and you need to decide quickly. And there's a lot on the line, right? It's an expensive project, or somebody's got to be let go. There's got to be a budget cut, right? And those are stressful decisions. So what I found fascinating when I look closer at the research, and there's some interesting neuroscience on this, is that men and women take risks differently when they're under stress. So backing up just a second. So let's say you're making a decision about should I get this risky medical procedure, right? So when men and women aren't feeling under a lot of stress, and they're making this decision for another person, right? They're thinking about, should this person who I don't know, should they have this risky medical procedure? That's not stressful for the person making the decision, right? If they're making that decision, men and women pretty much make it the same way in terms of they weigh the pros and the cons, they weigh the probability that the procedure is going to be a success. But put men and women under stress. Now they're making this decision for themselves, or they're making it for a loved one. Put someone under stress, and now men and women approach those risky decisions very differently. Men want to take more risks, and more risks than they would ordinarily. So men aren't just behaving differently from women. They're actually behaving differently from their normal selves. They want to, like, lean in and do the risky thing that might have huge gains, or it might be really costly. And that might be, let's just do the procedure, even though it's not tested. Let's just lean in and do that. Whereas women are more likely, when under stress, to go for the sure thing, the safe bet. Even though there might not be huge gains, it's better to go with the thing that we know works. And that's different from even how they normally behave. They get much more risk alert under stress than they normally would be, and certainly more risk alert than men are under stress. And
What's the neuroscience behind that?
Well, what they're finding is that, and you know this as a physician, under stress, right, cortisol levels go up. They skyrocket,
right? Stress hormone.
The hormone cortisol. Yeah. And what they're finding is that's true for both men and women. It's not that that's different, although I'm sure there are some differences. But for both men and women, cortisol goes up. But they're having different interactions in the brain in terms of what cortisol is doing. So there's a particular area just behind the prefrontal cortex that for men becomes really, really active when cortisol goes up. And that same brain area when cortisol goes up becomes suppressed for women. And so this is fascinating.
What is that brain area? What is it called?
I'm going to have to go. I can go look it up. It's
Don't even worry about it.
I hadn't read up on that before our conversation. But in any case, what you see is this very, very different physiological response in the brain, this different neurological response. And this seems to map on. This is happening at the same time that men are wanting to take more risks and women are wanting to put on the brakes on risk-taking. And so there's more neuroscience research to be done to study other brain areas and to also understand what's happening with other chemicals that are being released under a high stress situation. But it helps us understand why perhaps we need men and women to come together in important risk-taking decisions, because if you just have men in the room, which all too often we do in top leadership meetings, people are likely to take more risks than they would have ordinarily, or than they would have if they had had a more balanced room of men and women.
I see. Well, speaking of men, you recently wrote an article for the New York Times about research showing how testosterone supplements impair decision-making. Is this really true? I mean, are that many men taking this stuff?
Well, you know, I find this fascinating research. In terms of the number of men who are taking testosterone supplements, the number's going up rapidly. So in 2013, it was about 2.3 million men, according to the FDA. We're not quite sure now. People put the estimate sometimes around 4 million. But in the period of 4 years, from 2009 to 2013, it went up 65% in just 4 years. And a lot of these men who are... Yeah, exactly, right? I'm sure there are other drugs that catch on just as quickly, but testosterone supplements are becoming very popular. I know when I first read this research, I thought, oh, these are probably just retired men sitting out, at their like little beach house being harmless, right? And they're in their 70s and their 80s on testosterone supplements. But these are actually men, 70% of the men taking testosterone supplements are between ages 40 to 60. So those are going to be men who are, yes, right, active in the workplace. Those are going to be managers. Those are people who are in positions of power. So, and this is actually, testosterone supplements have become really popular on the stock market among people wanting to be what they call alpha males. Stock traders are taking testosterone supplements. So there's, is it half the country? No, but is it a growing number? Yes. And these are people often in positions of leadership.
Wow. I mean, so should we really be concerned here?
Well, I'm concerned because when doctors are advising patients about whether or not to take testosterone supplements, first of all, the research is showing that a good number of the men, close to 50% of the men on testosterone supplements, don't even have a testosterone deficiency. So they're being given the prescriptions even though they haven't, their testosterone levels don't warrant it. So yeah, that's concerning. Secondly, it's concerning because what happens is people, the men, the research is showing that when men take testosterone supplements, they're making more rash decisions. They're being more confident than they should be and more impulsive, and also less likely to take in the input of others because they're being overconfident in their decisions. They're less interested in what other people have to say, if that makes sense, Pam.
I'm beginning to wonder politically about one particular person and whether or not he's on.
It does make you wonder, doesn't it?
I'm just saying here. That's
I'm
all
pretty
I'm
sure
doing.
He's not going to give up that information, but yeah, it does make you wonder.
So this
data, some of it hasn't even been published yet. It's just coming out now about testosterone supplements and rash decision making. They did actually one team did a fascinating study with stock traders, so people who are actually working on the stock market. They gave them testosterone supplements, sent them home, had them come back. Half the men were on testosterone, half were on a placebo. Sent them home and had them come back in the next day, and they gave them a simulation. They didn't put them on the real stock market. They were smart about this, but with a single dose of testosterone, the men who had had that in the testosterone instead of the placebo, they overpriced assets. They were really slow to change their minds, even when the data was showing that they should sell. They were very slow to. So basically, they created a trading bubble, and it was really inflated, and it was really slow to pop because they were so overconfident in their choices. So could it be having a real impact? Yes, in terms of the stock market.
Oh my God.
And we've just seen a huge, the huge crash of 2009.
I'm wondering what the heck is going on out there. And, now I'm starting to break out into a cold sweat. Who's on the juice and who isn't?
I'm hoping that doctors begin to, and the patients begin to have this side of the conversation with their doctors when they want to go on testosterone supplements.
Therese? At the ads. Have all these ads about, are you low T? And then what's really low testosterone and what's high? Because quite frankly, the current norm in testosterone, right, is based upon like 20-year-olds. And so if you're 40, what's a norm for you? What's 50? If you're on the low end of testosterone, is that like a horrible thing? I mean, you're going to grow a third arm? I mean, there are so many questions out there, but guys aren't waiting for that. They're like, I need some more tea, so let's juice it up.
Right.
And they're doing it with the gels and the shots and the pills and whatever. Yep. I just think that it's a really funky science. Okay. Getting back to women, however.
Sure. Yes.
Right.
Yes.
If right now there are men and women who are listening to this right now on the Her mm-hmm. podcast, they're saying, how can an expert mm-hmm. like you help improve the work environment so that at the end of the day, you have strategies that, as you say, spark the best choices. So let's just, you know, give us some of your top, you know, two to three strategies that people right now listening can try to see if they can structure in their workplace, whether they're an employee or an employer.
Great. So one important strategy would be to make sure that when important decisions are being made, that you have both men and women in the room. It might seem silly, but when you're part of the group that, when you're part of the team that's deciding who needs to be in the room, make sure that men and women are both in the room and that women are truly listened to. There have been studies where, you know, you have a token woman and she's not involved in the discussion and she's ignored and you don't, the group doesn't come to any benefit by having her in the room,
right.
Obviously.
All right. So that's number one. What's the next one?
Number one. Number two is to be encourage people to take risks. So right now, there's a real bias for men to be the risk takers in our culture. And what that tends to lead to is the expectation that only men will take risks. And the reason that I say we should encourage risk-taking in the workplace is we want to make sure women are feeling comfortable taking risks as well. It's not that women take fewer risks, but there can be an expectation that if I want somebody who's going to go out on a limb, I got to pick a guy. So what you want to do is change the perception in the workplace that, like, no, both men and women are risk takers. So this is helpful for setting norms. And that way you're more likely to get women who are willing to step up for a really hard project.
Awesome. All right, number three.
And number three is to mentor women to be more 60-40. All right, so what do I mean by that? I got this tip from someone that I interviewed who's in the C-suite at a company. So she's found in her research, looking at marketing and men and women in marketing, that when women go into a meeting, they tend to want to be 80% sure of themselves before they speak up on an idea. Right. So they're willing to accept a little uncertainty, but they want to be 80% sure before they say anything. Where she said she found that men were much more willing to be only about 40% sure, and they were willing to have like 60% uncertainty. So that means that men are speaking up a lot more in meetings than women. There's other reasons why men speak up more in meetings that we could talk about. But she finds that women need to be have a much higher threshold, needing to be much more certain. So she coaches women
Excellent.
To try to be 60-40, meaning just try
I
to be.
I love it.
60% certain instead of 80%. Bring down that threshold.
I love this.
Yes.
No, I really love that whole issue of mentoring, but also, you know, that women really need to speak up and they need to understand strategically how to do that. And I think that all the women out there and men should run on out and get Dr. Therese Houston's fabulous book, How Women Decide What's True, What's Not, and What Strategies Spark the Best Choices. Please make sure to go to Therese, that's T-H-E-R-E-S-E, Houston, H-U-S-T-O-N, author.com, so that you can read more about what Dr. Houston is up to, because this is hot stuff. And like the New York Times said, this book is required reading on Wall Street and in anyone's street out there. Dr. Houston, thank you so much for being on the
Her Podcast. Thank you, Pam. It's been a real treat.
Awesome. Hey, everyone out there, remember to catch every episode of Her. Just hit subscribe on iTunes or on our show page at RadioMD.com. And just take a moment and rate and review our podcast, because I read this. Love it, love it, love it. I'm Dr. Pam Peek. Follow me on Twitter at PamPeekMD. And you can also check out our Her show page at RadioMD.com for all of our past episodes. Hey, thanks for listening. And stay well.